Today is Wednesday, April 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States pushes pause on administering Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine.
Health authorities are investigating rare blood clots and low platelet counts in six women within 2 weeks of getting the shot.
Plus, the Biden administration announces its plans to withdraw remaining troops in Afghanistan in September. And France's agricultural minister is calling a cold snap the biggest agricultural catastrophe of the century. We'll have these stories and more next. Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine has hit another roadblock, with the United States recommending a pause in using the shots. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
Health authorities are investigating rare blood clots and low platelet counts in six women within 2 weeks of getting the shot. One died. Dr. Anthony Fauci says the pause will give the FDA and CDC time to understand what happened and warn physicians not to treat the clots with a common blood thinner. In the meantime, for those who've received the shot recently,
don't get an anxiety reaction, because remember, it's less than one in a million.
If you got it more than 2 weeks ago,
it really doesn't mean anything. You're okay.
Johnson & Johnson's delaying the vaccine rollout in Europe, which was already seeing a vaccine shortage. The Biden administration says the move will not have a big impact on the U.S. supply, with Pfizer and Moderna ramping up deliveries. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Now, to better understand the concerns and the science related to the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine pause, I spoke with Paolo Verardi, Associate Professor of Virology and Vaccinology at the University of Connecticut.
So I guess, you know, one of the things that we have to highlight is that both the FDA and the CDC in their joint media call today, in an abundance of caution. So really, they are making a recommendation to pause vaccination until they have time to look at this more appropriately, to look at the data more carefully, and also to come up with recommendations for people that may end up, rarely, but may end up, you know, getting such a complication. So this complication here is called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. So it is thrombosis, these blood clots that happen, but in association with low platelet counts, something called thrombocytopenia. And that is a little bit unusual. In fact, heparin is usually recommended for use with thrombosis, but in this case here, it's not recommended, so the treatment is likely different. So that's one of the reasons why the FDA and the CDC are saying let's pause it for a little bit so that we can give better guidance on how to treat this. So this guidance, you know, will be forthcoming. We have to understand that this is very rare. So as of today, we have vaccinated here in the U.S. about 7.2 million people. They received the J&J or Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And we only observed that in six cases, with only one death. You know, one person is in critical care. It's one case and about 1.1, 1.2 million vaccinees. So it's very, very rare.
You mentioned that it's very, very rare, one in a million or so. Do we have an idea of how frequently these types of clots form if you take the vaccine out of the equation?
Well, that's a very good question, because you know that's what they're gonna be looking at. Is just because it's happening in people that happen to get vaccinated, it doesn't mean that the vaccine is causing that. I actually don't know the numbers. You know, what will be sort of the background numbers of these types of conditions in our population in the U.S., but CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices will be meeting, and that's what they're going to be looking at, really to try to see if there is actually a real link between this condition and vaccination, or perhaps if this is, you know, just happening by chance.
This is the second vaccine that has been linked in some way, either anecdotally or through science, to blood clots, the other being the one produced by Oxford University and AstraZeneca. Is this something that's similar to what people have been seeing and what they're researching with the AstraZeneca vaccine?
No, it's very interesting, because the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca vaccine, they fall into the same category of vaccines. They are viral vector vaccines, so they are based on an adenovirus. In the case of the Johnson & Johnson, it's based on a human adenovirus. In the case of the AstraZeneca, it's actually based on a chimpanzee adenovirus. But anyway, they fall into this category of adenovirus-based vaccines. And not surprisingly, both of these, you know, have been implicated now in this type of condition. I also need to mention that the Russian Sputnik vaccine is also based on human adenoviruses. In this case, both human adenovirus 26 and human adenovirus 5. So we'll have to see, you know, what happens with Sputnik if you know, some of these complications also happen in the population that has received it. But absolutely, you know, there seems to be a pattern here, and that's why, you know, a pause is necessary to take a look at the data and give people better guidance.
I have one last question for you, and this goes to a larger picture. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine are one-and-done shots and don't require the same refrigeration that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines do. So for many countries around the world, these vaccines were key to help them meet their vaccination goals and reach herd immunity. With some regulators saying that the AstraZeneca vaccine should only be administered to those over 60 and younger people should find other alternatives, what does this mean for the globe in terms of trying to reach herd immunity to get the pandemic under control?
Yeah, you're very correct, because, you know, these vaccines, J&J, AstraZeneca, even the Russian Sputnik, they are really important pieces of this puzzle, right, to get to that you know, herd immunity. So, you know, what do we do? Would we just abandon them? I would say that probably not, and for some of the reasons that you mentioned. For example, they tend to be more thermostable, right, than some of the other vaccines. They are easier and cheaper to produce. So we can't just ignore that when in a background of a pandemic like we are having right now. So as I told you, probably we're going to have, you know, better guidance in which groups should receive the vaccine, for which it will be recommended. And remember, we are also going to be better prepared to treat anybody that may come up with this type of side effect. You know, we'll be better prepared to treat them. So a combination of these two things will probably make the vaccines still an important part of this puzzle, you know, to get to that herd immunity.
That was the University of Connecticut's Paolo Verardi, an associate professor of virology and vaccinology. Much of Europe has been forced back into lockdown amid a deadly third wave of the coronavirus. But in Britain, however, pubs, shops, and services reopened on Monday as the government hailed its vaccination program for cutting infections. Henry Ridgewell has that part of the story.
Back in lockdown and stretched to the breaking point. Restaurant owners gathered in Rome Monday to protest government orders to close. This restaurant owner from the Veneto region said, "We are tired of this. We need to return to work. We just can't do it anymore." Italy is one of several European countries struggling with a third wave of the virus. France, Germany, and several other states have extended lockdowns. Doctors warn more young people are being hospitalized with the virus. Germany's Chancellor has this stark warning. She said Monday, this third wave might turn out to be the toughest of all for us. The surge is driven by the so-called B117 variant of the virus, first identified in Britain, which was hit hard in January. But now, Britain is bucking the European trend. Pubs and shops reopen Monday as hospitalizations have fallen to levels last seen in the summer. More than 60% of British adults have received a first dose of vaccine. Anthony Harnden is from Britain's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation.
There is a huge wave of third wave of COVID sweeping Europe at the moment, and that's in part due to the fact that not very high proportion of their population has been vaccinated. Vaccination programmes are complicated things, and they do rely on public confidence.
Polls show public confidence in the AstraZeneca vaccine in Britain is around 75%. But a majority of people in France, Germany, Italy, and Spain believe the jab to be unsafe. Confusion over trial data led to the vaccine initially being restricted to those under 65. But in a policy reversal, several countries are now restricting the vaccine to older age groups after cases of rare blood clots emerged among younger people. Dr. Peter Drobak is a global health expert at the University of Oxford.
These are very rare events. They still exist, but we need to balance that against the risk of developing COVID or developing severe disease or even dying from COVID. And in most places and for most people, that is a much, much, much greater risk.
Europe is trying to boost public confidence. France's prime minister was given the AstraZeneca vaccine on live television. After a slow start, inoculation programs are gaining speed, using vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, AstraZeneca and Janssen. Germany gave a record 720,000 doses in one day last week. But Europe's troubled rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine has implications beyond its own borders, as global public confidence in the drug appears to be falling. The AstraZeneca shot is cheaper and easier to produce than other vaccines and can be kept at normal refrigerator temperatures. Again, Dr. Peter Drobak.
And so for all of those reasons, I think this vaccine is of utmost importance. It's kind of the backbone of the global vaccination campaign.
The African Union last week cancelled plans to procure the AstraZeneca vaccine, citing a desire to diversify its options. The bloc said the decision was unrelated to concerns over blood clots. But health experts say it could further fuel vaccine hesitancy, and they are calling for global awareness campaigns to counter misinformation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden has decided to withdraw the remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021. 20 years to the day after Al-Qaeda's attacks triggered America's longest war. At a news conference, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Biden has talked with the Pentagon and other nations about his Afghan pullout decision.
His decision that he made was done through close consultation with military leaders, with his national security team, with partners and allies around the world, and with his objective in mind of ensuring we are focusing on the threats we're facing. We're doing that in close coordination with our partners and allies.
Now, for more details, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
Well, the president is going to come out and talk about this on Wednesday, but we have confirmation from senior administration officials and the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, also confirmed it on the record on Tuesday. Essentially, the United States is going to pull all of its troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th. Now, what is also interesting is there will be several thousand U.S. troops staying on the ground in Afghanistan beyond this May 1st deadline of this year that had been agreed to in a deal last year with the Taliban when Donald Trump was president.
Now, what does this mean in terms with the deal with the Taliban? Because during the past administration, final withdrawal of U.S. troops was always going to be condition-based. And during the past year, after the deal was reached with the United States, there have been acts of violence that the Taliban has claimed. So, what is the Pentagon and other officials saying about those conditions on the ground that warrant this final withdrawal of troops?
Well, this really, according to the analysts you speak with, is not so much about the Taliban upholding conditions they agreed to, but rather about the United States deciding that after 20 years, it's time to get out, regardless of really what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan. And the Taliban were supposed to show up at a meeting this month that the Turks had announced, but now they're saying, according to one tweeted response, that they will not attend that meeting in Turkey until the United States removes all of its troops from Afghanistan. So a big question mark looming over the overall peace process for Afghanistan. But of course, that big question mark has been there for some time.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief. An Iranian nuclear negotiator says that Iran will begin enriching uranium to 60% purity. That's higher than the program has ever done before and after an attack on its Natanz nuclear facility. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that story.
The negotiator's comment, quoted by the state-run IRNA news agency, comes after Iran's foreign minister warned that the weekend assault on Natanz could hurt ongoing negotiations over its tattered atomic deal with world powers. Those talks are aimed at finding a way for the US to re-enter the agreement, the goal of which is to limit Iran's enrichment of uranium and in exchange get relief on sanctions. Of Iran's latest move, the International Atomic Energy Agency says it was aware of the media reports but had no comment at the time. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The defense has started presenting witnesses in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the trial of a white former police officer that's charged in the death of George Floyd. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
A use of force expert, former Santa Rosa, California police officer Barry Broad, testified Derek Chauvin was justified in pinning Floyd to the ground.
I was acting with objective reasonableness.
Broad said Floyd was putting up a frantic resistance, and police don't have to wait for something bad to happen.
You just have to have a reasonable fear that somebody's only going to strike you, stab you, shoot you.
Broad testified he didn't think Chauvin or the other officers in Minneapolis used deadly force on Floyd.
I don't consider a prone control as a use of force.
Tape from court TV. After 11 days of prosecution testimony and a mountain of video evidence, the defense is trying to deflect blame away from Chauvin. I'm Ed Donahue.
With tensions escalating between Russia and Ukraine, Turkey is finding itself caught in the middle. Ankara, anxious to get Russian COVID vaccines and tourist revenue, faces a difficult choice as Kyiv seeks to purchase Turkish-made military drones. And Dorian Jones takes it from here.
With Ukrainian and Russian forces facing off over Ukraine's Donbas region, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has come out in support of Ukraine.
As Turkey, we have clearly defended Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty.
One spoke during a recent meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two nations have a defense cooperation agreement, and analysts suggest Kyiv is looking to expand its fleet of Turkish-made military drones.
The latest performance of Turkish drones in various conflict areas such as Syria, Libya, and Nagorno-Karabakh also seems to be stimulated Ukraine motivation in using and deploying those drones in the critical areas such as Donbas.
Last year, Turkish military drones gave Azerbaijan an advantage in its fight against Russian-backed Armenian forces over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. But the use of Turkish drones in Ukraine could raise tensions between Turkey and Russia.
I think if Ukrainians use Turkish drones against Russian tanks or cars, trucks, or whatsoever, then we have a problem. It looks, of course, Turkey will sell maybe another 25 drones. The contract is there.
On Monday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned Ankara not to make further arms sales to Ukraine. Meantime, Russia has temporarily suspended most flights and tourist travel to Turkey, citing concerns over COVID infections. Though some analysts see the move as a sign of Moscow's pressure. The pandemic has highlighted the complexity of Turkish-Russian relations. With Turkey struggling to find enough vaccines, discussions have continued on plans for Russia to supply and possibly co-produce the shots with Turkey.
We see that the relations between Moscow and Turkey, they can digest the conflicts. So the cooperation is so multi-layered that it can overcome the smaller conflictual situation like this one now around the Ukrainian Turkish military cooperation.
For now, analysts see Russia continuing to pressure Turkey over Ukraine, using vaccine cooperation as a reward and restrictions on tourist travel as punishment. Between politics and pandemic, Turkish resorts, normally packed with Russian sunseekers, are likely to remain empty for some time to come. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warns Myanmar could be headed towards a bloody civil war like Syria unless violence there is brought under control. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Human Rights Chief Bachelet is calling on all states with influence, especially Myanmar's neighbors, to apply concerted pressure on the ruling military junta to end its campaign of repression and slaughter of its people. She says many of the grave human rights violations being committed by Myanmar's military might amount to crimes against humanity and must be stopped. Bachelet spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the High Commissioner fears a continuation of these crimes could tear the country apart and lead to a civil war like that in Syria.
The High Commissioner states that there are clear echoes of Syria in 2011. There, too, we saw peaceful protests met with unnecessary and clearly disproportionate force. The state's brutal, persistent repression of its own people led to some individuals taking up arms, followed by a downward and rapidly expanding spiral of violence all across the country.
Syria's decade-long civil war has had disastrous consequences. The United Nations estimates 400,000 people have died. 11.7 million are displaced both within and as refugees, and more than 11 million people need international aid to survive. Shamdasani says credible reports indicate the past weekend in Myanmar was particularly murderous. She says the country's armed forces, known as the Tatmadaw, attacked civilians with rocket-propelled grenades and mortar fire, killing at least 82 people. She says some people are using makeshift or primitive weapons in self-defense, and clashes between the military and ethnic armed groups in Kachin, Shan, and Kain State are intensifying.
As arrests continue, with at least 3,080 people currently detained, there are reports that 23 people have been sentenced to death following secret trials, including four protesters and 19 others who were accused of political and criminal offenses. The mass arrests have forced hundreds of people to go into hiding.
Shamdasani says the country's economic, education, and health infrastructure are at the point of collapse. She says millions of people have lost their livelihoods and COVID-19 measures have been brought to a standstill. Bachelet calls the situation untenable. She says nations must cut off the supply of arms and finances to the military leadership that allow it to kill and seriously violate its people's human rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Myanmar military is attacking journalists and increasing censorship in its deadly crackdown against opponents of the February coup. Five major media groups have also been banned and the internet has been shut down. But Burmese journalists are not giving up. Steve Sanford brings us this story.
On the walls of the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, the Myanmar Army's legacy of brutality during the 1988 crackdown is clear. The association, founded by former Burmese political prisoners living in exile, is working to help other political prisoners and document abuses. It posts daily updates on post-coup attacks on civilians, including those charged, arrested, or killed by security forces. While the military has banned five major networks and increased internet restrictions, the group says modern technology will help them get the truth out.
This era is the 21st century, a time of rapid development. No matter what the military tries to do to threaten our lives, they can't stop us from reporting the tragic news.
Media groups like Burma News International have gone remote, due in part to the COVID crisis, and rely heavily on the internet. But the decision this week by Myanmar satellite companies to stop international broadcasts of banned media groups has increased pressure to get the news out by any means.
This time we have to rely on the community journalists, you know, the CJ, and also like some of the stringers. Since there's internet like a limitation, we have to rely on the phone. We can get the information, but it's difficult to send the photos and video.
Civil society groups and rights activists have joined in the struggle, holding rallies in neighboring countries like Thailand. With help from migrants and exiles, many social media sites are able to repost damning video clips recorded in Myanmar's new conflict zones.
I want to give a message to the protesters inside Myanmar that if the military had cut off the internet, keep filming the video and take pictures of the evidence. Then send all the evidence you guys have to us when you have a chance. Then we will post that in the public.
As the Myanmar army continues to limit free expression and suppress the documentation of human rights abuses, media groups reach out to new contributors and old methods to get the facts out to the world. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Chiang Mai, Thailand.
And finally, France's agricultural minister is calling it the biggest agricultural catastrophe of this century, a cold snap that threatens to wreak havoc on the nation's harvests, including that of legendary vineyards from northern Champagne to southwestern Bordeaux. Lisa Bryant reports.
The sound of sprinklers in France's eastern Burgundy region, one of several methods desperate wine growers are using to save their vines. In some places, April temperatures have plunged to as low as 6 degrees Celsius or more. It's not the first time French vineyards have faced severe frosts, but many say these are among the harshest in years. Some blame it on climate change. In many parts of the country, wine growers, large and small, fear a loss. Year.
We know that the Chardonnay, which have grown very nicely, you could see 10 days ago, the baby leaves appearing. This is dead. And this is the next crop.
Frédéric Drouin heads Burgundy's BIVD Wine Federation, as well as Maison Joseph Drouin, a four-generation family business with vineyards in the area's prized Chablis and Côte d'Or regions. He says it's too early to assess the overall loss.
But we know that from Chablis to Mâcon, it's not good. We know in Sancerre, in the Côte du Rhône, in Bordeaux, almost everywhere in France, even the people growing peach trees, apricot tree in the Rhône Valley, they lost their crop.
Notre objectif, c'est de mettre en place les aides.
France's government has declared an agricultural disaster, paving the way for state support. Agricultural Minister Julien de Normandie says this cold spell has unleashed the biggest agricultural disaster so far this century. For the country's iconic wine industry, the frosts add to a spate of bad news. The coronavirus pandemic has shuttered restaurants and hotels, sharply shrinking profits. It's also been hit by a drop in Chinese demand and Trump administration tariffs last year over an unrelated transatlantic dispute. These were recently suspended, and wine producer Drouin says many American consumers continue to buy French labels. There's also the long arm of climate change, which experts say will deeply impact wine growing. In Bordeaux, home to some of the world's most prestigious wines, the area Greens Party complains about a more immediate environmental downside. Smog and noise pollution from setting fires in vineyards and using helicopters to keep vines from freezing. Local Greens lawmaker Benoit Ollonier says while some wine growers are very environmentally conscious, the Greens' complaints reflect practices of other large-scale, more business-oriented owners, less concerned and connected with their communities.
They don't know much of the village people, and thus, because of this wine industry logic, they try to produce more and more wine and try to sell it the best price and to get the profit margin as they can, while totally disregarding the drawbacks they may induct on the environment.
Not everybody agrees with this assessment, but nobody disputes the pressure is on to save France's wine harvest. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.